Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Generation Y ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible. Starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
There are days like today where I am just too busy to get outside and go feed myself. And that's where DoorDash comes in. It's super convenient and they bring the food to me. Also, I don't like paying delivery fees. So I have DashPass. DashPass is an exclusive membership from DoorDash that gets you unlimited $0 delivery fees on eligible orders and members-only deals and discounts, all for only $9.99 a month. DashPass actually pays for itself in two orders on average. DashPass makes it easy to save at restaurants, grocery stores, and all your local favorites. Open the door to $0 delivery fees and savings you can't get anywhere else. Sign up for DashPass today only on DoorDash and get your first 30 days free if you're a new member. Subject to change, terms apply.
I'm doing okay, except for a little bit of sunstroke this week. I think I was out in the sun too long.
We were just on podcast we listened to with Jeremy Collins. It's kind of a fun discussion. I also was interviewed by Is This Adulting, which is Chris and Steve. They're two fun-loving guys, and they're great to talk to. I think their episode with me will be up next week or in the next few days. We did have, there was a raging storm going on when I was talking to them, so my power kept going out. Audio recordings and stuff got a little flaky, but I do share an embarrassing story with them. Anyways.
Well, last week we had mentioned that we're going to do a meetup in Michigan. Time is running short, so what we want to do is get your feedback. Would you like a live show? If so, we would have to have tickets for it, and we would have to have a pretty good venue to hold it at. If you'd rather just do a meet and greet without a live show, then that's easier to set up, of course, and doesn't cost anything. But we need your feedback. So please get to our Facebook page and click on events. Tell us in there what you're looking for if you plan to be at the Michigan meetup. You can drive in there from Ohio or Indiana or from Michigan into probably an area 20 minutes outside of Detroit is what we're looking at right now. If you don't have Facebook or don't want to use that, then send us an email with the subject line Michigan and just tell us if you'll be there and what your preference is, either a live show or just a meet and greet.
As always, thank you to all of our Patreon supporters. You guys are awesome. And what are we talking about tonight, Aaron?
Tonight we're talking about a killer by the name of Joseph Callinger, and his nickname is the Shoemaker.
Technically, he is a serial killer. Let's go into why he's called the Shoemaker.
When he was just 22 months old, he was an orphan because his mother had left her husband and had a baby with another man who she wanted to marry, but he was already married. And back in those days, having a child out of wedlock was not good for her. And so it was easier for her to put Joseph into the system. And he was placed within the Catholic adoption system because his father was Catholic. His mother was Jewish. He would be adopted by two people who had become naturalized citizens in 1928 and 1930, and they were Stephen and Anna Callinger. And they didn't want a young boy to raise to be their family. They wanted a young boy to raise to become a shoemaker. It was practicality, I suppose. And the way they raised him, well, we always talk about the nature versus nurture argument. This is very much a case of he was nurtured into becoming
a monster.
Some of the details in this episode will probably be a little disturbing. And as always, we'll try to be delicate about it, but there may be some moments where we have to be a little blunt.
There might be some vulgar language, so warning there.
Now, Joseph Callinger started life as Joseph Lee Brenner III. He was born December 11th, 1936, in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Joseph's mother was married and had a daughter with her husband, but soon after left her husband. She was not happy. She would meet another guy. She would become pregnant by him. And that really messed this relationship up because she was pressing for marriage. And then he had to come clean and say, I'm already married. And he had a family.
Whoops.
So she gives birth to Joseph. And for the first couple of weeks or so, she stays with him and she's nursing him and just really bonding with him. But this whole time, she knows that she's going to be letting him go because she's already got a daughter who was born within the marriage. And then she has this son who she can't take care of him. He's born out of wedlock. So at 22 months old, he's already spent a lot of time away from his mother. He's in an orphanage, but he gets adopted by Stephen and Anna Callinger. They're Catholic. German speaking. Anna came from Austria and she very much wanted to come to the United States. It was just the land of opportunity. She wanted a new life. Stephen came from Hungary. He was a cobbler, a shoemaker. They met each other here. He became a naturalized citizen in 1928 and she became a naturalized citizen in 1930. At the time, Anna really wanted a daughter. But Stephen wanted a son that he could make an apprentice. He wanted to teach him his trade and eventually hand off his store that he built to his son. The trouble is Joseph didn't get much attention in the orphanage. He was left to his own devices a lot. And after being adopted by the Callingers, that continued because they didn't really give him attention. So he was left to his own devices most of the time.
This is the most pivotal time of a child's life where they need interaction, they need communication, but in the orphanage, he's not getting it. And then his adoptive parents are the only communication really is bad or neglect.
And a really sad thing is, so he's born in 36. In 1940, his mother, Judith, would pay a visit to the Callinger home. Now, she gets the information from the person who represents the Callingers. So it was too late. The Callingers found out she was coming and they said, no, cancel. Don't let her come here. And they were told it's too late. She already has your information. She's on the way. When she shows up, she's not welcomed, you could say. It's kind of a cool atmosphere. She's there not because she wants her son back. She's there because she wants money. She wants something out of this transaction because she didn't get anything out of it. She literally let her son go, and now her son's off into a home, and she's got nothing to show for it. And she says, I want $500. This is a lot of money back then.
Yeah, and I don't get that logic because I think you burden the state with giving up a child.
And of course, the Callingers are not receptive to this. And she says, well, fine, I'll just take Joseph with me. And they said, no, you can't take him with you, but actually we'll turn him in and you can get him later. And she doesn't really want that. She really wants the money. In the end, she goes away with no money and they don't end up giving Joseph back.
And Joseph appears to be unwanted by his birth mother and even his adoptive parents.
The one thing you can say is that she does sign something to allow the adoption to become formal.
I get adopting a child. I get, hey, let's teach him a trade. Let's have an apprentice. But this seems more like enslavement to me.
But the Callender's household was very strict. They were very difficult to please. As Joseph was growing up, he did his best, he says, to please them. He did things to try and get in their good graces. He wanted a family, and that seemed unattainable. One of the things they would do to him is they would say, you know, we don't like your attitude. We don't like how you're acting. We're just going to send you back. We're going to put you back in the orphanage. And of course, that's pretty traumatic, right?
Yeah, they're holding this threat over his head that he's going to be tossed back in kid prison.
But the Callengers are keeping a close eye on Joseph, and they keep him pretty much separated from the other kids, although sometimes he'll get out. One of those times, he attempts to pull a girl's underwear down.
So he's acting out whenever he's given freedom.
In a strict household, if you do something that is seen as immoral, sinful, there's going to be a punishment, and he gets punished. The other incident that happens of note is that he gets kicked in the groin by a girl who's a little older than he is. So he heads home, and he's kind of stumbling into the door, and his mom wants to know what happened. And as soon as he tells her what happened, she immediately goes to, "What did you do to her?" He is punished for these incidents. We'll be getting into what punishment is shortly. But a couple weeks after that, he is taken for surgery. It's called a left direct hernia. It's congenital, something he's born with. But it's not just a simple hernia procedure, because this is after the surgery is all completed and they wake him up. His parents are there, Stephen and Anna, and they say that the doctor didn't just treat his hernia by cutting him open, but that he also removed the demon from his little bird. They told him that his little bird would never get hard again. And this is Stephen and Anna's way of trying to discourage any sexual thoughts or behavior within their child. They were basically castrating him by brainwashing him into thinking that his penis isn't going to grow and that it's never going to get hard. So it's useless to worry about anything sexual anymore.
But that doesn't actually work. I mean, it probably works in the opposite way that they expected. He's been acting out, and now he's got this twisted, distorted view of himself.
It makes him focus on his little bird a lot. So in that sense, it didn't work. But in the other sense, for a long time, if not forever, he really believed that his penis was small. And that's because his parents continually told him that it would never grow. It would just stay a small boy's penis. They're telling him he's fixed. They're hoping that this will stop him from being kicked in the groin, from pulling down girls' underwear. And then they continue to keep him away from other kids. Now, as he gets older, of course, his father is teaching him how to be a cobbler and teaching him the trade. And his father is very good at it. All the signs point to Joseph being really good at it, too. The only problem is his motivation. So one of the things his dad does allow him to do is he can go to the movie theaters on Saturday if he's filled a basket with these leather heel inserts. And so what he does is he has like a big piece of leather and he has a steel die that he places over it and he hammers it. Well, when he hammers it, it knocks the leather down. He can take it off and throw it in the basket, but he has to fill it up. Well, a lot of the time he didn't fill it up. So what he would do was he would trick them. They didn't actually look through the basket. He would just have to show them the basket and then take it downstairs. He was putting newspaper in the bottom of the basket and then putting the heels over it. So he didn't have to fill it up with as much as they had asked him to. Joseph would say, well, I don't like going to the movies by myself, but he also doesn't have any friends. Other kids don't really like him. He starts stealing from his parents. They have a closet where they keep rolls of coins. And he would go into that closet and just take rolls of coins out. And then he would find a kid and say, hey, I'll pay your way. Will you go to the movies with me? And of course, going to the movies? Hell yeah.
So he's bribing.
When they discover that he'd been stealing money, they wanted to drive the demon from his fingers. Now, remember, he had a demon in his little bird, and now he has a demon in his fingers. Their way of exorcising this demon is to light the stove and then to grab his hand, and they'll push it into the flame. And then they'll repeat it with the other hand. And they say, you know, you're a thief. You're shaming our family. He would go back to that closet. He would continue to put newspaper, you know, into the bottom of the basket. And then they would catch him stealing more money, and they would burn him again and again. Now, the punishments for his transgressions, they made him kneel on sandpaper for an hour so that he could pray. She also hit him in the head with a hammer a number of times. Because of that, he started throwing himself all around in the house, knocking his head into things until she chased him upstairs. These are some of the punishments. There was a time when he was walking to school with his mother. He would ask, hey, it's my birthday today. Why don't I have any presents? And she would say, every day is basically your birthday because we give you everything. We give you a place to stay. We give you food. We give you work. You don't need a present. And he pointed out to her, he said, well, I do have a Christmas tree I put up in the window. And she said, oh, I took that down. It's almost like they didn't really need him to be happy. They just needed him to work. They needed him to go to school. They needed him to be a good boy and not to sully their name. His adoptive father, Stephen, was a shoemaker, and he used a green-handled knife. He saw this knife all the time. Spending all his time alone in isolation, he started to fixate on knives, and he became fearful of it. And then when he was about 7 or 8 years old, he was taking a walk, and he discovered three boys who were engaged in sexual activities with each other. They noticed him and threatened him with a knife. One of the boys performed oral sex on him. But this is kind of when things would change, because he realized that if he had a knife, he felt powerful. Sexuality, which of course his parents never talked to him about except to say, don't think about it, don't do it. He started to associate sex with knives so that he would have power, so that he could have pleasure. And so one of the things he would do was he would have a knife with him, like a pocket knife or another kind of knife, and he could masturbate as long as he had the knife with him. Now, he decided to start trying to use the knife to gain power over other kids. And there were a number of times where he would tell a kid, hey, let's go down to the river and we'll fish. And the kid would say, well, where's your rod and reel? And he would say, oh, it's down at the river. But then the kid would figure out, wait a minute, you don't have a rod and reel. What are we doing out here? And then Joe would say, take off your clothes. And then he would always chicken out. He did that a number of times.
We'll see this pattern later on in life where he strips people down and then leaves them or doesn't do anything.
The other thing he started doing was, as he got a little older, he would cut a hole in the wall near his bed, and he would push himself into it while holding a knife, and he would get his pleasure that way. Now, his dad would discover this hole and would patch it up, but his dad never seemed, at least according to Joseph, to understand what the hole was for, because who would think that a kid would use a hole in the wall like that? Mm-hmm. At age 14, this is 1950, Joe meets a girl. He meets her at the movies. They start dating. When he gets around to finally having sex with her, he has to have the knife. Before he can have sex, he has to mutilate a picture of a woman in a magazine with his knife, and that gives him the power.
This is just a horrible pattern of behavior in training oneself to hate others, mutilate others, and it's all in a sexual arousal situation. I mean, there's other serial killers that are pretty bad, but this is one of the worst scenarios I can think of as a child growing up.
The doctor long ago took the demon out of his little bird, although he's starting to doubt that because the bird does get hard. Now, that same year, Joseph has, what would you call it, like a vision or something? He sees God.
I would call it a hallucination in a fit of delusion, yeah.
Paranoid schizophrenia includes hallucinations, delusions. So someone who is suffering from it can basically believe in things that aren't true. Even if you give them proof, you show them proof that they're wrong about something, they won't believe you. They just believe in their delusion. So they might believe that they're hearing something or seeing something that isn't there. And God tells him that he is going to heal people. He's going to save people by healing their feet. And as a cobbler, he has the means, right? He knows how to make shoes to fit people to give them more comfort. He believes that because of what God is telling him, that he can now help people. By taking care of the feet, he believes that he can cure everything else. He can cure war. He can cure famine, everything. Because everybody will be just right. You know, once you take care of their feet, everything else will fall into place.
Delusions. It doesn't make any sense, but it's based in some sort of reality in his world.
It's harmless.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there are shoe companies out there that have a similar message on their website.
Yeah, and he's not using a knife to chop up pitchers by doing this. So this delusion doesn't sound horrible to me yet.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles, and immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails, feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
Joe seems to be a little happier. He has a girlfriend. And that means he's socializing. Unfortunately for him, his parents, they don't want him to have this girlfriend. They find out that she comes from a poor family. So they tell him, you need to drop her. You can't date her anymore. All this will do is drive Joseph closer to her, and he will end up moving out of the house.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's what all kids do, is they move out. You know, when you give them ultimatums, it drives them further from you.
It's sort of a tricky situation for his parents, because he has gotten so good by this point at being a cobbler that they're paying him okay money, so he can afford the rent at this other place. But they also can't just fire him, because Stephen especially wants Joseph to take over the business at some point. His mom will file something with the state saying, you know, he can't really take care of himself. He needs to come back home. And that's denied, because they look into Joseph and they're saying, well, he hasn't gotten in any trouble and he's paying his rent. We can't do anything about that.
He proves that he's competent.
And this is the really good thing for Joseph, is he moves a few doors down basically from where his girlfriend lives. And he's quite a number of blocks, I think about 6 to 7 blocks away from where his parents live. So he's kind of gotten away from them, and he only goes over there to work. He can visit with his girlfriend whenever he wants. Now, her family, not big on him either. He doesn't have her move in because he's got this, he has this concern about what the neighbors will think, because the neighbors are actually talking with him and they treat him okay. So it's a new experience for him. He feels like he's starting to be accepted.
Well, and she can't live with him because that's living in sin until they're married.
Joseph drops out of school, and the reason he gives the school is that, hey, I'm fully employed. I mean, that's the whole reason to go to school, is so that you can gain employment somewhere. Well, he's already got it, so there's no reason for him to go to school anymore. But since his childhood was so screwed up, his dream is to have a big family and to have a happy home. He wants to do things differently, and he makes a promise to himself that he will make a difference, that he will have a good family, a happy family, and he will provide his children with a home like the one he wished he had had. It sounds great, right?
Yeah.
And he has this girlfriend, and they get married. Well, they elope.
Yeah, because their parents don't care for the other, and yeah, so they just elope.
And everything seems okay. I say okay because he can already spot there are issues with her. She doesn't like to pick up. She doesn't clean. She doesn't work. That's not what he had envisioned. He had envisioned coming home and that the house would be clean, and that she would make him dinner. Well, she doesn't really like to do that either.
His perfect little world is not matching his fantasy.
This is a person who lacks confidence. So he sticks it out, and they have a baby together. Then things get worse. She doesn't really take care of the baby, and she's still not cleaning. I don't think he knows how to deal with this. This marriage thing is much more than he had anticipated. I think he's just unprepared. Time goes by. She gets pregnant again. This time she says to Joe, I need money so I can abort this baby. And the first baby they had was a girl. The second one is going to be a boy. Joe tells her, you're having the baby. That's all there is to it. So he stands up to her on this because he's horrified that she would do that. This is supposed to be his happy family, and it's not so happy. Now with the new baby, when his son arrives, who he names Stephen, after his father, the daughter was named Annie after his mother. If you have any question about, well, was she really that bad? Well, yeah, he ends up having to take his son to the hospital. Joe is told, hey, your son is suffering from malnutrition. And it turns out that his wife was feeding his son, an infant, soda.
And that's it.
So this little boy has sort of an extended stomach, flat chest. He just doesn't look right. So his son's malnourished. I mean, this was going on for a while, though, because even with the daughter, after his daughter was born, he would come home and she would just be soiled.
Not changing her diapers. She would just leave the daughter disgusting all day. And this is probably causing rashes and exposing her to diseases and other things.
One day, his wife moves out, just leaves. Joe takes care of the kids and he's got to find a place for them because he works. But he starts looking around for his wife. He finally finds out that she's been seeing another man. He gets the license plate of that man's car. The man lives out of his car. But Joe tracks the car down, and inside the car, he finds his wife. The man's nowhere around, and she tells him to get lost. All around the car is trash because, you know, when they eat or whatever, they just throw their trash outside the windows when they're done eating. Not a pleasant situation. His wife's yelling at him, telling him that he's an awful lover, that he needs to get lost. This is probably, I guess, the first big blow to his dream of having this wonderful family. He can't get her back. Because he was working, he had to put his kids somewhere so that they were taken care of. He didn't have a lot of time with them. But he was telling himself, I'm going to make this right. I'm going to make sure they have a home. And he didn't really believe in himself. He didn't think he could get another woman to marry him. So that was kind of up in the air. But he really believed he would make another home for them. 1957, his marriage is down the crapper. She has visitation rights with her kids. He has to take the kids to see her. And it's really hard on him because that was the woman that he had planned a future with. He seems to lapse into a depression or something. He can't sleep. And his daughter starts calling her mom's new boyfriend, Daddy. So then he starts getting this pain in his head. He goes to the doctor, and the doctor suspects that it's a cerebral lesion. This is in September of 57. He gets placed in the hospital, but they find out that it's probably not a cerebral lesion. They let him out after 11 days.
They figure out that it's all in his head. Excuse the pun.
Yeah, it's anxiety, essentially.
So this is the first time he's diagnosed with a mental disorder in his lifetime. His diagnosis was psychopathological nervous disorder.
So his emotional state is causing these physical manifestations of pain and discomfort. While he's on the train with his kids, he meets a woman. Her name is Betty. She seems to play with his kids. You know, they start running back and forth and they're laughing and goofing around. She's very pleasant. Joe seems to take a liking to her. She seems to take a liking to Joe. There comes a time when he's no longer going to be taking his kids because he's going to keep them. He lets her know. He says, hey, I'm not going to be taking the train anymore, but I want to continue to see you. And they start seeing each other. When Joe was 21, they ran off to the same town that he had gotten married in before. And this time he marries Betty. Now, here's the issue with the second marriage is that the first one ended in flames, basically. And now with the second one, he's very, very nervous about it going south. So he wants to make sure everything's right. So one of the first things he does after he gets married to Betty is he sells her car so that she can't drive away.
Well, that's a good step in the right direction.
And you might wonder, well, couldn't she just take his car? Well, he doesn't have a car because he doesn't drive. But Betty is definitely different than his first wife because she keeps the house very, very clean. She cooks for him. She's very good with the kids. She also works. He gets another hallucination, and this one isn't God. This is, as he describes it, a creature in black with flames that gush out of its mouth. And this one says, go home at lunch and burn your house down. Now, at this point, he has a house with his new wife. He's got his kids. But of course, no one's at home at lunchtime. I guess Joe just listens to these hallucinations because that's what he does. He goes home, and at the back of his home is a shed, and he opens up a can of paint thinner, takes up a matchbook, strikes it. The whole thing's engulfed. He says watching all of that stuff, his stuff, burn brings him immense pleasure, more intense than sex.
And this is really out of the blue for his behavior because he hasn't lashed out like this. He hasn't behaved oddly to this extent.
And that's in 1958. So the family moves out of that home, and Joe and Betty are sort of making things work. And Joe's providing for the family, but they're not really spending time together anymore. He's really focused on his mission to save the world, how to fit the shoe properly. Then he has an incident where he's not feeling good, and he tells his wife he's going to go to the doctor, only he doesn't make it to the doctor. He ended up kind of far away. He was confused. He didn't know who he was or what he was doing there. It was Hazleton, Pennsylvania. They take him to the hospital. They diagnose him with amnesia. They don't really know what to do with him until at some point he mutters out this phone number, and the person who answers the phone is Stephen Callinger, his father. And they say, well, he's going to be discharged on this day. And he says, fine, I'll come get him. So he was gone about 9 days. And by this point, his wife had left with the kids. She moved in with her mom because she didn't know what was going on. She figured Joe probably left her. She didn't know what to do. Joe, of course, he gets out and he wants to find his wife and his kids. They're not at home. And so he's freaking out. He thinks, oh, great. Okay, so now wife number two is leaving me. I'm going to track them down. They're not going to get away. He finds out that she's with her mom. So he calls over there and his wife says, oh, okay, well, I'm coming home then.
Okay, this is interesting.
Well, it gets more interesting because while he was at the hospital, there was a point at which he had left his bed, and the nurse discovered that he was missing and went looking for him and found him in a closet where he tried to commit suicide. So was this when he was not sure of who he was? It's difficult to say because he was supposed to go see his doctor, and that didn't work out. His wife had called his doctor and said, hey, what's going on with Joe? And he said, I don't know what you're talking about. He's not been here. It's another strange incident like the pain in his temples where Like, what's going on with this guy? Now, his behavior at home gets strange, too. He spends time with his kids. So he's kind of an attentive father, but he's having them do weird things. Over the years, he and Betty have a number of children, and he wakes them up at odd hours to do things for him, like to clean the shop or to go out with him, just looking garbage cans or going door to door and asking for old shoes. There's no telling when he's going to get them up and do these things. He's also moving large equipment into his living room. It's stressing his wife out because she kept a very neat home, and now she has all this large equipment where you literally just have one path that you have to go through to get to the door to get out. Meanwhile, Joe has been taking things apart, thinking of new ways to use them or how he can use them as part of his experiments.
It's so weird how people can be so far gone. I mean, most of us are thinking, why isn't she calling somebody? There's something wrong with him. But when you live in the situation, I don't think you have as clear of a picture as somebody from the outside.
Well, we can look at his behavior, though, and how things worked. And that might explain why she didn't call. Whenever the kids had an issue at school, it was Joe who went to the school. Whenever the kids needed punishing or something like that, he did it. His wife, while she took care of the home, she didn't really step on his toes.
He was competent enough to look like he was still sane.
He was definitely the alpha. And so he ran the show. This whole disassembling things and his fascination with the equipment, he had that early on. When he was a kid, he talked his parents into letting him go on a camping trip. He got to shoot a rifle, and he snuck the scope off the rifle and put it in his pocket, and then snuck off later on and disassembled that scope, and he took the lens out. And we start talking about mental illness and what was possibly going on with Joe, or what we probably know is going on with him. This gives you some idea, because he would take that lens out and hold his hand out and then put the lens over it, and everything would get bigger through the lens. So he thought he was becoming a giant with the lens. So it gave him a power.
And then we're back to trying to burn his house down.
Yeah, between 1963 and 1967, there are four fires. There are two fires in May of 1963, one in August of 1965, and then a final fire in October of 1967. The prior fires were accidents. The 1967 fire, well, he gets taken to court over it. And he does have a number of witnesses who come forward and support him. They're character witnesses. He ends up beating it because he didn't have insurance on the house. So it wasn't, he didn't set fire to fraudulently cash in on insurance.
There was no monetary gain from this.
Yes, there was a gain on the first fire he set, and he got $1,600. It's 69. He's working his kids. He's having them do all these strange chores, looking for old shoes, and having them up at all hours of the night. And he buys another building, like another house, but it's just for him. He thinks of it as a warehouse. And the first thing he does is he gets his kids in there, and he makes them dig a pit.
This is a huge pit.
And he fortifies it with these planks and puts a ladder in. This is where we see how his kids interact with him, because his son Joe doesn't really like his dad. You can tell he's defiant. And when he says, okay, kids, you're done, you can go, well, Joe flips him the bird and says something like, screw you and screw your hole.
I think it was 20 foot by 10 foot hole in the ground. I mean, it's just insanity.
It was a lot of work, and he didn't help at all. He just supervised. It's really strange. He has all these complaints about his childhood, but he's not really making a great childhood for his own kids. And the first time he goes into the pit, he starts hearing a voice that's speaking a strange language that he doesn't understand. And it turns out, as he's touching his own throat and his face, he realizes he's the one that's chanting in this weird language.
It's like speaking in tongues, and the voice is coming from within.
Now, another thing that's going on is one of the guys that testified on his behalf at the trial for the arson fire of his home lives across the street from him. But now Joe doesn't see him as an ally. He sees him as an adversary because he thinks that that man works for the CIA and is spying on him. So he'll start taking these pinballs and he'll start chucking them out of his window to break this guy's front window so that he'll board it up. And what he does is he breaks the window and then he'll call the man and he'll say, "Hey, someone broke your window. Do you want me to help you board it up?" And he would say, "Man, thank you so much." So Joe would go over there. He'd help him board it up. But then within a couple of days or so, the guy has a new window put in. Then he has to re-break the window.
And he's doing this so the guy can't look out the window and spy on him.
After like several times, the guy finally puts in the different kind of window. So then he'd have to break both sides. So he just gives up. So Joe puts these black screens in his windows so the man can't see into his home. Now he doesn't have the light coming in. You know, before he had all the sunlight coming in when he'd work on his experiments to perfect people's feet. Now he just has his lights on in there. And apparently he can't open the windows or anything. So anything that he's using as part of these experiments or as a cobbler, now he's just inhaling that stuff. It doesn't have anywhere to go. It's not going outside. So probably not real good working with all those chemicals with no ventilation.
And people will report that he has a particular smell about him, and it's actually the smell of glue that he uses. It's a very harsh chemical smell.
As time goes on, Joe is becoming more and more paranoid. He decides that he needs to fortify his home, and he does that by installing steel bars over the windows. And he also decides to re-educate his children because they are too defiant. They're running around in the streets. His daughter may be having sex. Also, his sons might be having sex. So he needs to fix them. And the way he's going to do that is he's going to take them one at a time to the basement, to the torture chamber, as the kids called it. There was a metal table and rope, straight pins, rubber hose, strips of leather, and a cat of nine tails whip. As Joe puts it, what would happen was when it was time to take a kid down there, he would take one of his three oldest, and he had this vision of this clock that would rise out of the darkness. It would have all the numbers on it, except instead of a 12, it would have a skull, a white skull. There would be flashes of lightning around it. He would get an itch in his hand. And then it would basically indicate which child needed re-educating. Their punishments were all a little different. Mary Jo, when he would take her down, he would strip her, and then he would throw the straight pins at her, and he would whip Joey with the cat of nine tails. So he's re-educating them, but he also feels guilty later, so he'll give them rolls of coins. I remember, like, back in the day, he would steal rolls of coins to go to the movies. He would bribe another kid to go to the movies with him with these rolls of coins. Now he's bribing his kids with rolls of coins, like $5 or something, and say, "Hey, you know, here you go." It seemed like, especially Mary Jo seemed to, I don't know if forgive is the right word, but she would quickly act like everything was okay again, despite the torture. Weird incident happens in 1971. This is July of 1971. I don't know where his wife is or what's going on with that, but he starts dating his own daughter. And by that, I mean, he starts taking her out. He buys her jewelry and he starts looking at her in a romantic way. I think she doesn't mind this because she's not being tortured and he's not torturing anyone else during this period either. So
how confusing for a child. Yeah.
But it's sort of a welcome change, I guess, because they're not being abused. But after a few weeks, he stops because now he's thinking, this isn't right. I'm not supposed to do this. He's out one day and he sees his daughter walking with a boy named Freddie Prince, who happens to be 19 years old. He'll ask her, like, "What are you doing?" And she'll say, "Oh, that's Freddie." He's like, What is that necklace you're wearing? You know, where's the one I gave you?" And she says, "Well, Freddie gave me this." And he's really upset. He's becoming jealous and his daughter knows it. Well, this makes him really, really angry. The other thing that's going on is his kids have made friends with a family. They're hanging out there a lot. He also thinks his daughter's having sex with Willie, who's one of the kids over there. He's also 19. He doesn't really know for sure they're having sex. He just suspects it. His kids do some really weird things. You have to wonder what is going on with these families.
He knows his children are getting into trouble. It comes out that his son, Joey, is selling sexual favors to other boys. So his son's selling the favors, and his daughter is collecting the money for these favors. Who knows where they're getting this from, but we can only assume that their treatment at home is driving this really poor behavior.
The kids, they're tired of the abuse. Joey and Mary Jo run away. And Joseph just about, he hits the ceiling, basically. And he tells the rest of his family, get in the car. He grabs a gun. He said, we're going to go get them back. And he will go to pick them up. He shows them the gun and says, get in the car. Now, as I said, Joe can't drive. So the car that I'm talking about is a taxi. And he has the driver pull up next to him again. He jumps out with the gun and he's motioning, get in the vehicle. They do. They figure they're going to get shot. This is when his punishments really take a dark turn, because up till now, punishments weren't anything like this. I know he tortured them, but that was part of his re-education. He is seething mad. And as he puts it, he wants to punish them. He wants revenge for them, their attempt to abandon the family. He doesn't want this family to break apart. He wants the family to be together, and he's going to make them stay together. He handcuffs his son, Joey, so that he can't go anywhere. And then he takes his daughter and he ties her up, strips her down, and he has a spatula, and he heats this spatula up to where it's red hot. And he will start placing the spatula against the inner thigh. And he will do that, he says, a couple of times. She says it was more than that, but just burning her over and over there. Later, he would be asked, why would you do such a thing? And he said, because he didn't want her to have sex. And he was jealous. He didn't want her to have sex with these other men. So he figured if she hurt really bad there, that she wouldn't have sex. And then he goes back up to his son and he takes the head of the hammer off. And so he's left with this wooden handle and he starts beating his son with it over and over again. Things have escalated. We talked about how he went through abuse when he was young and he was hit with a hammer. He was made to kneel on sandpaper. He wasn't given any love. Well, he's given these kids some love, but he's also given them torture and abuse. And so I'd say if you're looking at it, things are getting worse. That was on January 23rd of 1972, and he is arrested for child abuse after his kids go to the police station and say, our dad is torturing us. He's abusing us.
And they check their injuries and they coincide with their statements on how he's abusing them. They take this very seriously because these two children came to the police, reported this. Everything matches up. All the evidence is there. So they take Joseph into custody.
They have plenty of evidence. So in June of 1972, he is found guilty of child abuse. He's given 4 years probation, and they want to send him for psychiatric treatment. But his children will turn around and say, oh, no, 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 no. They sign statements saying that they weren't abused.
Yeah, they sign affidavits that recant all of their previous statements. But he's still diagnosed as paranoid schizophrenic, but they have to drop a lot of the major charges against him because they feel they don't have much to stand on because the children will not press charges. I have an issue with this because I think these are children. They are minors. The evidence is there. Why do you need them to testify at this point? The state can go ahead and go forward with this, but they decide that they don't have as much of a case against him now, and they abandon their charges. But I don't get this at all, because he's obviously abusing them. Their statements matched up with the evidence, but the state, they have a moment of doubt and they abandon the charges with him. So he goes back home and his children get to go back home. And this is probably the biggest missed opportunity of his whole life on preventing what's going to come up next.
1974, Joseph's mental state is deteriorating.
He starts hearing a new voice named Charlie, which happens to be a disembodied floating head that gives him orders. Some of these orders are from God. Most of the commands are violent, and they're telling him to, Charlie's telling him to murder young boys and remove their genitalia. He will ask his son, Michael, for help with this. And Michael, sure, Dad, I'll help you out with whatever. And he wants to go on missions with his dad. It's about 11 days later, and they find Jose Collazo, who is a Puerto Rican kid in Philadelphia. They torture him, remove his penis. Now, they will not be caught for this. This murder will go unsolved for many years. At the same time, Joey has been put in a mental hospital. He's having a lot of issues. Obviously, I think he's following in the footsteps of his father, and they're diagnosing his son with all these different issues. Well, Joey's the one that rebels.
He's so bad that he gets kicked out of every school they put him in, even the school where you send the worst of the worst kids.
So Joey's defiance has ended him up in this hospital, but once he gets out, his father will start taking out life insurance policies.
The policy's worth $45,000, and he takes it out on Joey and another one of his younger kids.
He will then report Joey missing. The police will not be able to locate his son. Following month, they will find Joey's body in the basement of a demolished building that's a few blocks away from Joseph's house. Now, his body is crushed, not beyond recognition because they know who he is, but they're unable to determine cause of death because of all the damage caused from the demolition of this home.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman, passes the savings on to you, and Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices. Along with premium fabrics and finishes, how can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY. Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/GenY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GenY.
Now, he submits a claim, but the insurance company won't pay up.
Weird, right?
In November of 1974...
he will start taking his son, Michael, out on missions, and they will walk up to houses and ask if the Joneses are home. Some of these houses, they will rob the people inside. Sometimes they will walk up to people on the street and attack them. These attacks will happen all over town.
Now, his hallucinations, again, take a weird turn because his daughter, Bonnie, gets a skin condition, and he's told that he needs to collect certain things to treat her condition. While this is disgusting, this is what happens. He's told that he needs to collect women's vaginal fluids, semen, and some other things to mix together to create a salve to treat her skin condition. And he does just that, and he will mix it with water and rub it on Bonnie's skin, although her skin never gets better. Joseph Callinger and his son Michael, they go to New Jersey and break into a couple of Lindenwald homes there. The first one they break into, only the dog is home, and they steal about $2,400 worth of items from the home, packed into a suitcase. And then they break into a home and terrorize a woman. Her name is Joan Carty. According to Joe, Charlie is floating around him and encouraging him to kill her. The first attempt at her door is by his son, Mike, and Mike's asking if she wants to buy any tie clasps. That doesn't work, so he returns a short while later, holding up a dollar, and he wants to know if she has any change. Well, she doesn't. So then, Joe decides to walk Mike up to the door, and they get her attention. And she looks out and he asks her, has this boy been trying to sell you anything? But she can't really hear him, so she has to open the door. And she says, yes. She feels like something's wrong, so she quickly tries to shut the door. And they get into the house. She can't stop them. He bound her wrists and ankles after he strips her. And they rob her house of her jewelry and her possessions. Any valuables. Joe tells his son that he intends to spend some time alone with Joan. And encourages him to keep going through the house to find anything valuable to take. He will also tell Mike that he intends to kill her, but when they leave, he's not killed her, and Mike seems disappointed. And that's kind of a good overview for what happens, is they break into a place, they tie the people up after stripping them naked, and then some sort of rape happens.
But it's on June 8th. That they will be walking through a neighborhood, and many people will see a man and a young boy walking, holding hands. They will say that the boy is acting effeminate and skipping along, doing things that are unboyish. A local postman will see them scanning houses. It looks like they're trying to case houses. He definitely thinks they're up to no good. Lucy, a neighbor, will see them pass by her home, and they'll end up on Dee Dee Romaine's porch. They will knock on the door, and she will answer. When she opens the door, the older gentleman identified himself as a John Hancock salesman, and she isn't really into the way he's presenting himself. She thinks that he's shady. She doesn't understand why he would bring a young boy along. So she starts to tell them, I don't want anything, and close the door in his face. But he will shove his way into the house and pull out a gun, bring her into the living room, and she starts screaming and fighting with him. And he will start trying to bind her. Her son, Robert, will hear this commotion. And he will come into the room, and Joseph will see him, and he'll have to get a hold of the situation. He tells her that this is a robbery, just do as I say, and nobody will get hurt. He pulls out a knife and screams at her, "Don't look at me." He wants to know if there's anyone else in the house, and she says that her invalid mother is there.
He sends his son in to check and make sure that the invalid mother is there, that the story checks out.
Yeah, and she's there, but she's not moving. After he's secured the home in his own mind, he will bind and gag her. He will tell her to remove her clothes, but she'll shake her head and say no. So he will strip her down. He will also take her 4-year-old and bind and gag him and lay them both down on a bed upstairs. During this, Dee Dee's sister, Randy, will come home, but the front door is locked. And this is the time of innocence where people were not locking their doors during the day. She will knock and ring the doorbell to see if anyone's home. And Joseph will go down and open the door and grab her, drag her into the house, and take her upstairs. She's freaked out because she sees her sister and her sister's son, her nephew, there. And she wants to know that they're okay because she just sees these people that have been stripped down and are bound and gagged. Joseph will allow her to check them for life to make her feel better about this whole situation, I guess. And then he will do the same to her. He will ask her before he gags her, "Is there anyone else coming home?" And she'll say, "Yeah, a lot of people are coming here." He doesn't believe her. So he puts the gag on and goes back downstairs and goes through their house, starts rifling through their stuff, trying to steal what he can. He also removes all their jewelry, their watches, whatnot. And there's yet another knock on the door. Edwina Romaine and then Retta and her boyfriend, Frank Welby, are at the door. Now we have 7 people at the home. I'm wondering when Joseph is going to abort this mission, this home invasion that he's in the middle of. But he pulls out his gun and he brings these 3 people in. He binds and gags them. Frank is an older man. He thinks that he could actually break free. So he takes Frank down in the basement, strips him down and ties him up down there and lays him down on the furnace and incapacitates Frank. He has his son hold the gun to Frank's head and pretty much hold the gun anytime they're tying people up. There is another knock at the door, and it's their neighbor, Maria Fashing. He grabs Maria, drags her into the house. The floating head of Charlie is directing this whole incident, apparently, this whole attack. And he brings Maria down into the basement to Frank and starts telling her to mutilate Frank, tells her to chew off his genitals. And she's not wanting to do it. She's screaming. He pulls her to the other side of the basement. He will end up slashing her, cutting her throat. Frank's down in the basement, but he doesn't see what's happening. He just hears her screaming, saying that she can't breathe, and he hears gurgling noises. But the furnace turns on and drowns out the noise of her screaming, so he's not sure what's happened yet. They tie all these people up, and his son is trying to tie up Edwina, and she can't really move her hands behind her back, and he can't tie them up very well. But she's older, and Joseph says, "You know what? Just tie her legs and her feet. That's fine." While they're down in the basement, Edwina hears the screams and thinks they're just going to come up and kill the rest of us. And they probably were going to. Edwina will jump up. She'll run to the front door. She'll unlock it and run out of the house screaming. And she'll run across the street to the neighbors, knock on their door, fall down on their porch. And the neighbor will open up the door and she'll tell her, "Untie my feet," because she just wants to get away. And Lucy, the same neighbor that saw the man and the little boy walking around earlier, she runs to the neighbor's house. She will just call the police immediately and tell them that there's something happening. There's a woman screaming. She'll give them all the information she can. The police will show up.
They will question Lucy and Edwina. Edwina will tell them that there's a man with a gun and a young boy. They've tied up her family. So the police will run over to the other house. They'll enter the home. First, they'll see somebody bound behind the couch. They'll draw their weapons. They'll say, please move out. Retta will scoot out from behind the couch, naked and bound. Obviously, she's a victim in this situation. So they keep moving through the house and they go upstairs. They find the rest of the family that's been bound and gagged. They will inform them that Frank is down in the basement. So they'll head down to the basement, and that's where they find Maria. Her throat has been cut and she's hunched over. She is bled to death. And then they find Frank, who's tied up over by the furnace, and they get him untied and released. And they start putting out APBs because they have multiple people now that are giving them descriptions of this older man and his young son who have perpetrated this crime. They have one person that's been murdered. They have others that have been sexually assaulted. There's a woman named Eva Rumi who was out walking her dog, and she will tell police that she watched a man and teenage boy approach another kid that was playing basketball. The man took off his coat. The boy removed his shirt. They were just kind of stripping their clothes off and leaving it around this park. So the police will start gathering up these clothes, searching around. They will end up finding a blood-spattered shirt. On further searching, they will find a laundry mark with a name on it. They will find a watch and a few other things, but it's the shirt that they find that really gives them something to go on. This laundry mark, it's from a local cleaner down the street. They go there with this blood-splattered shirt. The owner will immediately say, that's Joseph Callinger's shirt. And they say, well, how do you know that? And it's because of the smell. The shirt smells like that toxic glue that Joseph uses when he's working in his shop. They get an identification from that. Now, the name Callinger is misspelled or truncated, at least, because the receipt machine at the laundromat can only do like so many letters. I think it's like 8 letters. So they have to drop a letter off of his name. They have this name now. And they start doing searches. They're not finding anything in these searches because they have the wrong name, misspelling the last name because of the laundry mark. But now with the full name Joseph Callinger from the laundromat owner, they are able to search their database and they will find a Joseph with a background. And it's his arrest for his child abuse. In this file, they'll find his address and photographs. Of course, take these photographs and to all the witnesses, and they positively ID him, which is a good thing. They'll go to the house, find that Michael's there, but his father is not. But then they will find a weird passageway in a wall that goes into another home, and they assume that he's fled, he's left, he's run away. So they go next door to the other building that this secret passage goes into, and they find him on the phone with his lawyer. Yeah, and they will take him into custody. Of course, he doesn't want to talk because he wants his lawyer present. Take his son Michael into custody, and he will yell at Michael, don't tell them anything. Michael will abide by his father. So they have multiple people that place him at the scene of the crime. Police departments will check out other local departments and find that they are responsible for a lot more attacks across the city and have many, many more victims. He is ranging from beatings to robberies to sexual assault. This will go to trial, as they all do. During trial, Joseph will behave oddly. He will make noises. He will seem very much disinterested in the proceedings. His first trial will end up with a mistrial during jury selection, so something went terribly wrong there.
During jury selection, the judge dismissed the prospective jurors because they watched the erratic behavior of Joseph Callinger. Well, that would be prejudiced. You know, they would be prejudiced against the defendant because of that. So the way to describe this is, you know, many people didn't think there was really anything truly wrong with Joe other than he was an evil person. So for them, they were like, you're just acting up. You need to get out of here. Come back when you can act right.
His defense attorney, Giblin, and the prosecutor, Larry McClure, will have a never-ending parade of psychiatrists and psychologists to evaluate Joseph's mental state. The prosecutor pretty much alleges that all of his outbursts during court are a performance and he's acting. There's nothing wrong with him. Meanwhile, his defense attorney will try to bring up a lot of his past, a lot of the things that happened to him when he was tortured as a child, and a lot of the accounts that his own children bring up before the murders. But ultimately, Larry will get his way and the state will deem Joseph Callinger mentally fit and competent to stand trial. He's going to be treated like a serial killer, which he is one, but he will not be considered mentally ill. And that will not be allowed into trial as a mitigating factor, even for the jury to decide on.
Well, and you have to understand, for the prosecutors, they're looking at this as, if he's found to be mentally ill, then there won't be justice.
Yeah, and he will be found, I guess, not guilty due to reasons of insanity as opposed to being put away for life. I do think that he needs to be removed from society and put somewhere for life, but I think it's pretty obvious at this point that there's something wrong with him, and he has been diagnosed previously on several occasions of being a paranoid schizophrenic or the other things we'd brought up. Let's just say the evidence is overwhelming in the prosecutor's favor. It's pretty easy for them to obtain a guilty verdict, and they sentence him to life in prison. Now, while he's in prison, he will decline in health, mental state, and they'll end up moving him to a mental hospital for a period of time where, again, they diagnose him with paranoid schizophrenia, among a litany of other disorders. But because the courts don't acknowledge that, he is treated and then sent back to prison. And in prison, they put him in solitary confinement for up to 2 years, some outlandish amount of time. He will be sleeping on the floor, and he will tell the guards that Charlie is occupying the cot and taking possession of it. He will hallucinate badly. His health just completely declines. Now, I'm not saying feel sorry for the guy, because I sure don't, but is this what we want to do with our mentally ill or our criminally insane members of society? We just want to throw them in a jail cell and throw away the key? I'm not okay with this. I'm not okay with him being out in society either, but this is not helping. This is not rehabilitating him, nor is this even really punishing him, right?
Yeah, that's a good point, because if someone's mentally ill, if they're disturbed, or in this case, I mean, we know Joseph Callinger disassociates from reality, basically. He hallucinates. You're punishing someone who may or may not be there.
Being in prison for the rest of your life is not pleasant for anyone. But if he's not even sleeping on his own cot because he thinks that Charlie's sleeping in his cot, this isn't punishment anymore. This is just as insane as Joseph Callinger is. I get that we want justice. I get that we want punishment. I understand why the prosecutor did what they did. We removed this guy from society. Is he truly punished? Are we extracting justice here? I'm trying to get to the bottom of it. I mean, I think all serial killers are probably unstable, have issues, mentally ill. It doesn't mean that I want them walking among us. I just want there to be some sort of treatment, I guess. I don't even know how to what the answer is here.
We want solutions, I think, right?
Yeah. And most serial killers are manipulative. Most serial killers do have command over all of their faculties. But in the case of Joseph, this guy is, he's totally gone. It just makes me have an even lower opinion of our psychiatric world if you can find one doctor who will deem him competent to stand trial, and you'll find a bunch of others that say no. Well, if this is science, if this truly is a science, then he either should be competent or not. There shouldn't be a dissenting opinion here, right?
Well, I think we can find dissenting opinions just because of the nature of the prosecution versus the defense. But I know what you're saying. You know, there's plenty of evidence here that Joseph Callinger truly is disturbed. He has real issues.
He lived in a pit.
Yeah, he had that pit that he would speak a strange language in and would get visits from the devil, basically. He also did experiments on these hamsters, and he would make the hamsters run on a wheel until they died. And he did this over and over again with these four hamsters that he named. And I mean, to me, if you think about it, his mind's really disturbed. He said that if the hamster would just successfully run the wheel, then he could do that with elephants. He could do it with humans. And to you and I, we think, wait, if you run anybody to death, you're just killing them. But in his mind, all it had to do was listen to him. It's like you believe it and it will be true. You can't make sense of this. You really can't. It's because Joseph Callinger is screwed up. He's paranoid schizophrenic, among other things.
And just so we don't forget this little detail, but you can find a few interviews with him on YouTube and online. And the reporters that are talking to him will ask him, why did you do this? And he says that God gave him a mission to kill 3 million people, and that he started with his son to see if he could do this. But we know that he didn't actually start with his son. And then an author will actually, the author who wrote the book Sybil, will interview him and end up writing a book about him.
The book is The Shoemaker. It's by Flora Schreiber.
What did you think of the book, Aaron?
The book is very detailed. I mean, really, to understand just how psychotic Joseph was, you probably should read the book.
We left out a lot of graphic details, some real nasty stuff, because as much as it proves the point that he was insane, I think we gave enough examples to get that point across, I hope.
Yeah, I think simply knowing that he had to hold a knife while he had sex, how he associated sex and knives, that alone is disturbing. And it's something that other serial killers have shown in the past, where violence and sex are intertwined.
I think it's a vicious cycle between his parents abusing him, his foster parents. He goes on, and the cycle of abuse continues. They were lenient with his son, Michael, because obviously he's a very young child under the influence of his father being told what to do. So they give him therapy. They put him in a juvenile detention center, but they do not try him as an adult.
Yeah, his parents were abusive towards him. They didn't give him love. He had promised himself that he was going to change that. But as soon as his first wife left him, I think that was the writing on the wall, that this was going to get worse. His faith, I guess you could say, in humanity, in his future, was in doubt. And because his mind wasn't stable, everything just got worse. And he went back to what he knew. He knew abuse. And that's what he dished out. I believe that much of the public that looks into this case will find no sympathy inside of themselves for Joseph Callinger. And that's because they don't believe him. They don't believe he's as ill as he says he is. It just comes down to the question of, does he believe it? Or is he putting on a show? And if he's just putting on a show, people just think he's a scumbag serial killer. Take him out. Put him to death or let him rot in prison. But he doesn't really need treatment. And, you know, these things are, there's too much to go through. Just getting his kids up at night, killing Jose Collazo, being told that he's given orders to kill 3 billion people. Either he's making it up or he's suffering from paranoid schizophrenia. And if it's the latter, then it would have been nice if he would have gotten treatment. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.